I'm surrounded by violent men, who have assaulted women, yelled at me, men who break things in rage. I know men who are in or who have been to prison for violent offenses. And yet they all seem to agree on one thing. I'm angry and they're rational and emotionless. No matter what I say or how I say it to my husband, my dad, my brother, my boss, my male colleagues, if I have a problem with anything, I'm the angry one. I'm the scary one. I'm the emotional one. To these men who have tantrums and break things and engage in violence because of their angry emotions. When I read Zahn's piece on patriarchal rules, asserting that anything men do is rational and that anything women do in opposition to it is emotional and crazy, it clicked into place. They don't actually think I'm angry. They just want me to shut up. Hi, I'm Zahn Vilines, a writer and feminist activist, and this is the Liberating Motherhood podcast. Today, we're talking about women, anger, and how the stigmatization of women's anger furthers the goals of patriarchy. Before we get started, just a few quick administrative reminders. You can visit all things Liberating Motherhood at my website, liberatingmotherhood.org. There's also a form there to submit podcast vignettes, feminist advice questions, contact form. Pretty much any question that you might have is answered there. You'll also find book lists, tons of resources, and links to everywhere else you can find me. And of course, the main place to find me is on Substack, zahn.substack.com. If you like this podcast, I really hope you'll consider leaving a positive review on your chosen podcast platform. Reviews, along with shares, comments, and engagement, really help to support the podcast and ensure that more people can find it. This then, in turn, allows me to make more episodes. So, on to women's anger. My guest today is Gemma Hartley. Hi, Gemma.
Hi.
I am so excited to have you here. So, let me tell you guys a little bit about Gemma. Gemma Hartley is a freelance writer with a BA in writing from the University of Nevada at Reno. She is the author of Fed Up, Emotional Labor, Women, and the Way Forward. And this is how I discovered Gemma. Her book is amazing and has contributed significantly to my understanding of feminist philosophy and of women and anger. She has a new book coming out, No One Loves an Angry Woman, which will be out in September of 2026. Her Substack of the same name, No One Loves an Angry Woman, explores feminism, anger, domestic labor inequity, and more. She also has an amazing Substack for writers called Creative Commitment. Gemma, I'm so thrilled to have you here. So let's get started.
All right, I'm really excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yay, thank you for coming on. So your book grew from an article you wrote for Harper's Bazaar, Women Aren't Nags, We're Just Fed Up. The title alone is something I think so many of us can relate to. How did you get interested in this topic, and how did it give birth to your book, Fed Up?
Yeah, so this was a topic that I think was just kind of blooming in the general consciousness around the time that I wrote that article. And this was a time when I was freelancing and writing maybe 10 articles a week. I was writing constantly. And so I didn't really have any idea that this particular article would blow up in the way that it did. And I had agents approach me and ask me if I would like to write a book on this topic. I ended up going with my agent, who I love, and got a book deal with HarperOne to write Fed Up. And I had to do a lot of research very, very quickly on the mental load and emotional labor in order to write the book. I had a 6-month deadline, and it was a real whirlwind writing that book. I sometimes wish that I had done a little bit more research before, that I had had a little bit more time to sit with the subject, because there are so many changes I would make to this book if I were to write it today.
Yeah, that's fair, and that's kind of how it goes. I also started out as a freelance writer where you're just throwing things into the void and seeing what sticks, and then something does, and then you have to like make that your whole thing, and I think it can be pretty challenging.
Yeah, and I think the nice thing about the book that I'm writing now is that it's coming out so long after my first book that I have a lot more freedom with it. And I've had a lot of time to sit with this topic of women's anger and, gender inequity that I've experienced throughout my life, largely through growing up in an evangelical community. And it feels like I finally get to say many of the things I've wanted to say in all of these interim years.
Yeah. So, okay, it's interesting that you mentioned growing up in an evangelical community because I find that there is this like pipeline with women where they start out evangelical and then they get kind of a little shred where they think something is unjust and then they go down a rabbit hole and they get kind of radicalized and they end up like basically where you and I are. I guess talk to me about how anger is depicted in the evangelical community, how women in that community are raised to feel about anger.
Yeah. So, I think that your reader who sent in that vignette got it exactly right. They don't think that you're angry. They just want you to shut up. And so, if you even veer into questioning the way that things are, not even getting angry, just questioning, you're told that you're being irrational, that you're being sinful, and conversation is just shut down at the source. And I think that that builds up a lot of rage and resentment, even if you're not going to acknowledge it. And so when you find that little, nudge towards feminism or towards, recognizing injustice, I think you're right. There's a really big, like, evangelical girl to radical feminist pipeline. I wrote about this recently on my Substack about how I'm not actually all that afraid of what is happening with, evangelicals gaining so much political power and, having all of these evangelical children. A lot of them are going to be women, and a lot of them are going to turn on their family of origin and their faith of origin once they realize their own subjugation.
Yeah, it's really interesting how I found through my own work, I've converted, I guess, for lack of a better term, a large number of evangelical women. And the ones who contact me all tell me the same story, which is that they found my work because they were searching to solve a problem with their spouse. And at first they thought that I was crazy and angry and something to avoid, and they hate followed me. And then they started reading more, and then they got radicalized. And then, like a few years later, now they can't stop themselves from, every time they hear about a woman going on a date, for example, telling her to just murder the man instead. So I think that's really interesting. And I think that, when we tell women to be silent for so long, we can expect that they're going to be like really, really angry after a while.
Yeah, and I think when you finally start to reckon with all the ways that you've been silenced throughout your life, anger is the natural response to that. Anger is just part of being awake to all of the things you were told didn't exist throughout your life. And I used to be really afraid or ashamed of my anger, and I see it as a really powerful tool now. It is what brings me clarity and shows me that I'm moving in the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's not an accident that we want to silence women's anger because
No.
before you can change anything, you have to be angry about it. So I want to get to that, but I want to talk a little bit about fed up first and about emotional labor. One thing that I see so often is this idea that household labor inequity is just a small, trivial matter. It's something to laugh about. Tee-hee, look how stupid and incompetent men are. Pundits talk about it as if it's just a dish in the sink, just a minor difference in standards and preferences. There's the she left me because I left a dish in the sink guy. But depending on which data you believe, men are creating an average of an additional 7 to 12 hours of work a week for their partners. And that's on top of the ways they undermine their partners with mediocre or bad parenting, emotionally abandoning their partners, and just generally making life more stressful and less fulfilling. This to me is like the total theft of a person's life, opportunities, and dreams. So why do you think we, and like even so many of us in the feminist movement, pretend this is a small thing, a distraction, a trivial issue?
Ooh, I mean, I feel like in most feminist spaces, especially over the last 5 years, we've started to come around to what a big deal this is. Not just the domestic labor inequity, but the aspect of the emotional labor and mental load, which is all of, the noticing, planning, delegating, overseeing work. Alison Damager breaks this down really well into the different parts of cognitive labor. And then there is the emotional labor aspect of it, which is doing the emotion management of everyone around you. You have to ask in the right tone. You have to, make sure that your requests are clear enough because there's this misconception that men can't possibly understand what you're asking them to do, or they can't possibly do this job well. And one of the things that I am exploring in my next book is that a lot of this belief is rooted in Christian patriarchy and Christian ideology, and where our ideas about men's incompetence and, women's work being really trivial come from is from complementarianism. The idea that, like, well, men aren't wired for this and women are. And so, therefore, because you're wired for it, it's not really labor. And because they aren't wired for it, they can't take it on. And it's really insidious. Most people don't recognize that that comes from within religious ideology, but it absolutely does.
Oh my God, it's so true. I mean, that's the thing that I hear all the time is that, well, women are just better at it. And it's completely complementarianism. And then there's this sort of secular version, which is this like evolutionary psychology bullshit of, well, women are this way and men are this way. And we love the just so stories because it's a lot easier than confronting that men are doing this deliberately because it's easier for them. You talked about emotion management, and I want to zero in on that because I feel like that's something that we're not talking about as much right now. This idea that women have to manage other people's emotions and manage their own, especially in the context of like men's weaponized bad moods. I had a reader refer to it as the passive aggressive male presence in the house, that if he's angry and brooding, she has to keep like putting new coins into the slot until she finds one that works. Tell me what you're seeing in your research about that.
Yeah, the emotion management work, it's another distraction, right? It's another way to keep women from talking about the things that actually matter, the things that would, increase their ability to enjoy life. If you have to manage someone else's emotion, if they're not going to be responsible for their own emotions, women have been tasked with managing that for a long time. And the idea of emotional labor and emotion management comes from Arlie Hochschild's research, which was very specifically like within the capitalist framework of she did a lot of research around flight attendants who had to put up with a lot of misogyny and keep a smile on their face. But women do this in their personal lives as well. They are tasked with keeping a happy home. It's one of the reasons I really hate the whole like happy wife, happy life kind of reframing of this because it's women that are keeping everyone else happy. And we do this not only with our partners, making sure that, like, oh, let's tend to his emotions and make sure that he's okay. And often that means doing all of the domestic labor around the house, doing all of the mental load work so that we're not burdening him because he's already in a bad mood, right? And we do the same thing when we're out in public. I write a lot about this in Fed Up about how we have to take in the emotions of those around us when we're in public spaces. And this comes in with, sexual predation and getting catcalled on the street basically is like, okay, how do I not escalate this situation? How do I maintain my safety? And that safety happens out in public. It also happens a lot within the home, which we don't talk about as often.
Yeah, I mean, I have this piece I wrote about a year ago. It was called something like, the threat of violence lurks in every unequal relationship because it is that violence that men use to reinforce this. Even if an individual man would never be violent, the woman understanding that he could be and that men often are and that they almost always get away with it keeps her compliant and keeps her in line. So that's, great and really scary. You talk a lot about like managing men's emotions, and I think that's really interesting because men, of course, have this idea of themselves as rational and not having emotions. And if you talk to like a men's rights activist, he'll prattle on about how, men aren't allowed to share their emotions or have their emotions. And I feel like women's emotion management labor that we do constantly enables men to feel that way. It enables men to think, oh, we're rational and we don't burden anybody with our emotions, because women act as if we're not burdened and we act as if men's emotions aren't really emotions. They're just rational and reality and sort of the default settings by which we determine everything else.
Yeah, well, and I mean, that's just how we operate as a society. Whatever men do is the standard, and whatever women do is the aberration. And I think that, men do have this idea of themselves as being rational and not emotional. And part of that is social conditioning, where, we venerate men's anger and we, shut down oftentimes like the sensitivities and full emotional range of men. Women don't do that. Men do that to other men. And then it gets taken out on women who bear the burden of that emotional labor. And I think that it's so interesting that men have this belief still that they are so rational because they are generally only putting that emotional labor onto their partner or women in positions that cannot, fight back or speak up about the emotionality that they're expressing.
Yeah, I mean, there's only one gender that is committing like tons of acts of violence and tantrums and all of that because of their emotions, and it's not women. So, okay, so let's talk about women and our anger that is kind of simmering below the surface that we're never allowed to express. It's obvious to me that the women are angry for a reason, and that anger is really the only rational reaction to living in a patriarchy. Which is exactly why we stigmatize anger. We want to pretend women are crazy for calling injustice exactly what it is. And I think that if we stigmatize women as angry, we stigmatize them as irrational, and often in fundamentalist evangelical circles, stigmatize them as like flighty, less reliable, less intelligent, then it's very easy to silence them. So talk to me about the important role that this stigmatization of anger plays in patriarchy and what we can do about it.
So, I think that when I think about how silencing women and specifically women's anger works in the favor of the patriarchy, I always come back to this quote from Gerda Lerner from The Creation of Patriarchy. And she says that the system of patriarchy can function only with the cooperation of women, and angry women are not cooperative women. And she goes on to talk about like the different ways that you secure cooperation. One is gender indoctrination, which is really big in the church, that complementarianism that women are, made for a submissive role. And I feel like I experienced all the things that she lists: educational deprivation, the denial of women's knowledge about their history, dividing women from one another, which has been a big goal of the church for many years. It is, the genesis of the witch hunts was let's break up women. Let's put an end to gossip and knowledge sharing. And then, defining respectability and deviance and restraining women from feeling their full range of emotions. And I think that you're right that anger is the only logical response for a woman living in patriarchy. But when we tell them that anger is not a natural response, that sense that like we want belonging within society will keep us quiet, especially if our community consists of, a religious community that really banks on women's silence in order to continue operating.
Yeah, I think that's really, really potent. I had a reader probably a couple of months ago point out that Most women don't really have deep connections with other women and don't know what their daily lives are like. And so they think that their very political experiences are highly personal and their own fault. So yeah, I think that's true. And I see it in my own work too, this sort of dividing women. A lot of women will tell me that they really like my work, but that they can't read it that much because I'm so angry and I'm so mean and I'm so negative. I'm not positive enough, or that their husbands don't want to read me because I scare them, because we're supposed to talk about our oppression without ever being upset about it. And, I intellectually recognize the dynamic that's going on here, but I also have this immediate reaction of like, but I'm so nice and I'm so rational. Like I'm not angry. I'm not a bad guy. Like, look at me write so nicely about grief. And I think that if you get enough of that, you start to just kind of temper your message ever so subtly and try to spend some time proving what a nice girl you are. And then, of course, that is time taken away from more meaningful work.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, one of my greatest regrets about my first book is that I was trying so hard to be nice. And I've gotten the comment that like, oh, you're so approachable to men in this book. And I've even heard from some women that, because I spoke to men in that book in a way that was measured and easy to hear. Some, good guys, and I'm putting that in air quotes here, felt emboldened to cherry pick through my message and feel, like they didn't actually have to change and feel victimized and, all the things that men love to do when they twist messages that are trying to speak to them gently, that are doing that emotional labor. And I don't write like that anymore. I am really unapologetically angry. And I think it's going to lose me a lot of people because I think when you talk about the women that say, I can't stay with you in this anger, they can't stay with their own anger. It's too scary, because they know that down that path of anger is going to be rejection from a lot of the places of power that have held them close. So getting that proximity to power, I think, is one of the things that keeps women silent. Like, oh, well, men aren't going to turn on me if I continue to be nice, if I continue to swallow my anger. I can keep the peace and I can keep this proximity to power that is not full power, that keeps you in this place of actual powerlessness. But you don't have to, be fighting against the patriarchy if you're going to hide your anger. And once you release that, you can't really shove it back in.
No.
And so I understand why women don't want to face their own anger because you don't know what liberation is actually going to feel like. And it looks really scary from the outside and from everything you've been told.
So I will tell you this, which is that I think and I hope that you might be surprised by the positive reaction you get to being sort of more authentically angry. Because, well, yes, that does come with some rejection. I found that overwhelmingly people say that they're refreshed by my direct tone and that they're happy that I'm saying the way things really are. And, kind of on a personal level, there's not much reward in being accepted for work that isn't really you. But when you do work that is your authentic self and that is accepted, like that feels really good. So I just want listeners to bear in mind that anger does come with rejection, but saying what you actually think can help you connect meaningfully to other women. And also, you may be surprised by how accepting people can be because, like, anger is our reality and oppression is very much our reality right now.
Yeah, and I think that I will lose some people and I will gain others. And the people that I lose are not a loss to me.
Okay, so you mentioned this thing about men contacting you and like cherry picking your work. And I have to ask you about this because I get this all the time and I'm just curious if it's happening to other feminist writers. Do you get men contacting you seeking your like validation and feminist stamp of approval so that they can then weaponize it against their partners?
Oh my gosh, yes. And it drives me absolutely crazy. And often what I'll say to that, if they email me or privately message me, a lot of the time I won't respond. But if I do, I will just tell them, I'm not going to give you a fucking cookie. Like, you've come to the wrong place. I am not here to give you a fucking cookie for your good behavior. You are showing your misogyny by reaching out to me right now. And I have no tolerance for it anymore. I used to engage with so many men who were purposefully misinterpreting my work
Oh God, I
and
know.
trying to clarify myself, and like, oh, so much wasted energy. And now it's like, I block, I delete, or I tell you I'm not going to give you a fucking cookie.
Well, and then it's like you engage with them in good faith, you try to help them, you give them evidence, you walk them through all the way up to the feminist door. And then what do they say? They say, "Well, I've lost respect for you. You're just one of the bad feminists." It's like they never actually walk through the door.
Yeah, there is no good faith that I've found in any man who feels emboldened to take up my time.
Yeah, they're just, oh, it's exhausting. I feel like I want to do a whole podcast episode about just the men who email me and how much they upset me. It's unbelievable the stuff that is like constantly sitting in my inbox and probably in yours too. And like people always think it's like the death threats, but it's not. It's these like faux good faith bros who are just like, and one more question, and one more question, and one more
The
question.
worst. And when I recently had this experience when I wrote a Substack piece on like just the really abominable treatment that a lot of women experience within their relationships, where they are basically begging their partners for help and men are turning away from them. And I had so many men come into my comments and be like, "That's horrible. Let me tell you about what a good guy I am."
Oh my
And
God, I
like,
saw that. I started typing so many hateful comments to so many of those men, and I finally just had to like leave my office and get away from the computer because I was just gonna like bomb your Substack.
I mean, I would allow it. Also, I blocked a lot of them, so they weren't able to respond. I went on with some of them because, like, I choose where I direct my energy, and because it's my comment section, and I know the people that are reading my comment section might find value in some of these talking points, I will engage in the way that I want to. And boy, does it piss them off when you're not going to take the bait that they're trying to lay for you.
Yes. Or when you ban them, they all say the same thing, which is that you've suppressed my ideas and you've silenced me and you're fearful of the truth. And it's just, oh God, it's so infuriating. Okay. So
Yeah, it's like
on
it's
from.
my space. I get to choose what I want to do with it, and you're not welcome here.
But don't forget, you're a monster for having your own space because every space belongs to men and they should be able to come into everybody's space and say whatever they want without any consequences. And we should not be
Yes.
able to talk back to them because they have freedom of speech, but we don't.
Exactly. I'm like, my dude, you're on my Substack, like my personal blog, essentially. I can kick you out.
I know. I wish that I was the government silencing you like forever, but sadly, I am not. Okay, so I think a lot of women worry that they are being irrational or unfair when they're angry. One of the most common questions I get for my advice column is like, a woman will itemize all of the horrible things her spouse has done. And then she'll say, and I do admit that I'm angry. So do you think I'm being unfair? And it's like the answer is never no, but something about having that angry reaction makes a woman question everything she thinks.
Yeah, because we're supposed to be ashamed of our anger. Our anger is ugly and unfeminine and not allowed. And so, as soon as we transgress that boundary of anger, it's like everything that has been done to bring us to that point is null and void because you have crossed the uncrossable line.
Yeah. So what is the, What is the mental trick going on with men where their anger is a sign of righteousness and their commitment to justice and goodness, no matter what they do with that anger and no matter how violent it makes them, whereas our anger is unacceptable and also exists even when it doesn't exist. Like they'll call us angry for just like asking for something politely.
Yeah. And honestly, I don't know that it is so much a mental trick as it is just so much conditioning and reinforcement. And a lot of it I, view through the lens of evangelical Christianity and the fact that men are supposed to be like the direct line to God, essentially. I mean, literally. We have an entirely male succession of popes. Almost all Protestant Christianity will only allow men to be leaders. And so anything that men do, again, it becomes the standard. And anything that challenges that standard is not allowed. And so women are not allowed the full spectrum of their humanity, which very rightfully includes anger.
What do you think of this new thing? You talking about evangelical Christians has me thinking about this new trend I'm seeing more and more of supposedly secular men talking about masculine and feminist energy, feminine energy, never feminist energy. And I just want to die. Like I just every time I see it, I just feel this like withering disgust where I want to hide under my desk that this has become like a normal, acceptable thing to talk about of, well, you need to get her into her feminine so that she can submit to you. Do you think that
Wow.
this is like, I don't even know what my question is. Just say something about that. What is this?
Well, I mean, put simply, it is complementarianism, that idea that men are meant for leadership and women are meant for submission. And I think that it's very appealing to even secular men because they want to hold on to power. And they don't understand that, feminism or even matriarchy is not an inversion of the power structure. It's not women over men. It's just better for everyone. And I think that the desire to go back to this traditional idea around masculinity and femininity, really as described within Christian ideology, has to do with the fact that men are so stunted by the way that they are raised within our culture and the ways that they are unwilling to grow. This is something that I see time and again as women start to reach middle age and start to sort of come into their anger, come into their power. There is this, whole trope of like women reach 40 and they go crazy. Like, no, they just can't put up with all of this bullshit anymore. And their anger has to go somewhere. And oftentimes that awakening leads to divorce because women are growing. Women are constantly in this state of like self-improvement. And a lot of that has to do with the patriarchal standards of we need to figure out how to, carve out space for us in this world that will not allow us any. And so we're constantly like tweaking and making adjustments to our lives and growing in a way that eventually leads us to, the real answer that patriarchy is the problem. But men, a lot of the time, are in this space of like, well, I'm still the same guy you married. I just haven't grown at all since we first met. What's the big deal here? And I think that the fact that men are so unwilling to grow is what makes them want to go back into this little comfort zone of traditional masculinity, of like, if I'm the only one that has these masculine traits or masculine skills, then I don't need to feel threatened by women who have their full humanity. If we can put women back in the submissive box, that would be great for my ego. And so I think that's where a lot of it is coming from.
Yeah, there's just I've written a lot about how patriarchy really disrupts men's ability to think critically. And like I've talked about it as a brain disease because I really do think it works that way. When my oldest was a toddler, my husband would do this like modified version of the wheels on the bus, where he would talk about like different people getting on the bus and what they said. And you know, the sexist man would get on the bus, and the thing that he says on the bus is, "I can't change, I can't change." And to me, that's like the whole of like patriarchy and relationships is this idea that you cannot ask a man to change, that that's fundamentally unloving and like unfair and unreasonable. And women are just supposed to perpetually change. Like if you look at any mainstream marriage advice book, it's about all the things that women have to accept and all the positions they have to contort themselves into to change to accommodate the man. And it's just like it's so sad. It's outrageous.
Yeah, and I think that's so true. The idea, this is why complementarianism is so alluring for men, right? It tells them you can't change, or that, secular biologicalism that says, no, you can't change. Any sort of gender essentialist ideology says, well, you can't change, so you don't have to try. You don't have to grow. You don't have to feel all of the uncomfortable feelings. And I think the reason that women are able to grow into their anger and grow in such, magnificent ways as they age is because they have lived a life of discomfort. So what's the point of staying in the discomfort that doesn't serve you when there is the discomfort that leads to your liberation?
I love that. And that's what it is you have to, what is the quote? It's like hope has two beautiful daughters and one of them is anger to change things. Yeah, you have to get angry about the way things are to correct them. So, okay, we know that men are weaponizing this trope of the angry woman and the angry feminist. We know that kind of no matter what we do and how we ask, it's going to be stigmatized as excessively angry. And we're going to have this ridiculous idea that women are the scary, emotional, irrational ones. But we still have to live in this world where men keep doing this to us, even when we know that it's just ridiculous and infuriating. Have you tested any scripts for responding to these claims of anger? Have you found anything either that works or that is satisfying to say when a man is like, "Oh, you sure sound angry."
I think the most satisfying thing is to not say anything to them at all. I
Oh.
think that one of the things that I have learned over the past few years is that men, these men will come in and act like they are asking these questions in good faith and saying, if you changed your tone a little bit, if you were a little bit more rational, then maybe I could hear you. Maybe I would change. They kind of are dangling this carrot in front of you to get your compliance. And if you say, fuck your carrot, I'm going to stay angry, they have nothing else that they can do. And I've gotten into so many good faith arguments with men, and they are never, ever interested in changing. They are interested in taking up your time and your energy and your mental space. And if you just say, no, that is mine and you can't have it, that's all that I need to do. It keeps me clear and focused. And I think one of the things I hear so often, even from women, is like, well, what about men? How do we speak to them? How do we get them to understand? And I was like, if they wanted to, they would.
Yes, it's not a failure of
It's
understanding.
really true. And I think what gives me such freedom to say that is that I have a partner that is fully able to accept me in my anger, who listens and understands my full humanity and does not turn away from it. He doesn't need me to speak really rationally. He doesn't need me to be smaller in order for him to be big. And that sort of liberation within my own relationship allows me to get really angry with the men who do not give me the same fullness of my humanity.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's well, and that also speaks to the real tragedy of most heterosexual relationships because I'm also in an equitable marriage with a feminist man, and I see how deeply affected I am by the patriarchy that surrounds me, and I don't understand how women who have no escape from that at home are able to continue functioning. And These marriages are really destroying women, and they're bringing the patriarchy into your home and making it such that there's just no safe place anywhere. So, yeah, agreed. One of my favorite things to do with angry men on the internet is that I'll, type out my response, which is increasingly just mocking. They don't respond to evidence. So I'll mock them and then I'll wait until I can see that they're typing a response, and I'll let them type for like a really long time because I know they're sending me a wall of text, and then I'll block them before they can post their wall of text. And I don't know how it makes them feel, but it makes me feel great, and that's all I really care about.
Yeah, and I've had so many men this week, like on social media, trying to reach out to me and tell me, if you were a little bit less angry, if you weren't talking down to us. And I was like, who are you? And I'm just not going to respond. I think it's so liberating to not try to convince men that you get to take up space.
What about in settings where someone commands authority? Because this is where I see it a lot, that there's not an easy escape for women. It's especially common in couples counseling, which is so often a tool of reinforcing patriarchal marriage dynamics, where the woman will go in with complaints that are usually sexual coercion, household labor inequality, low-grade abuse of the kids by her spouse, and emotional abuse and neglect by her spouse. And the therapist will tell her that her anger is the problem and that she needs to work on her anger and also probably like give him sex that's painful and unpleasant for her. In these settings, we can't block, we can't ignore. What do you recommend women do? Is there any way to redirect attention away from the woman's anger in these sorts of, really sexist contexts?
Oh, yeah. So I have a lot of issues with couples therapy because I think it does really reinforce gender hierarchy. It is really a place where patriarchy seeps in and makes things often worse for women because it's like, oh, well, we've got to listen to both sides, even though one side is like, I would like basic dignity, and the other side is, I would like to coerce someone into sex. Like, I would like to go back to where it was legal to rape my wife. And so I have a lot of issues with couples counseling. And it has a lot of Christian roots and like eugenics roots as well. We don't have time to get into all of that. But I think that when you are in a situation like that, what often is going to happen is men are going to really want to stay with a therapist who reinforces those gender hierarchies within the home. And you don't have to stay in that relationship with a therapist, especially. I know that oftentimes women do have to, stay in relationships because marriage is built to uphold patriarchy. It is built to keep women, beholden to men. But in a therapy office, you do not have to put up with that. You do not have to stay in that situation. And you can say that, like, no, this isn't the problem. And you can actually, you are allowed to call out that bad behavior and that bad ideology that your therapist is espousing. It feels like you can't, but you absolutely can. It's just a social construct that you think like this person is a position in a position of power. No, they're not. You're paying them. You can absolutely tell them to fuck off.
That's such an important message. I women just have this ongoing obligation to make things work and to people please and to keep trying and keep trying and keep trying. And this trying distracts us from becoming and doing whoever and whatever we were meant to be. So yeah, I would just add, like, don't pay someone to inflict misogyny on you. You can get in misogyny inflicted on you for free, usually at home from the person who's supposed to love you.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, if you could share one core message about women and anger, if you could get women to accept one thing, you can change the world, and you have one thing that you're going to tell women. What do you think they need to know, or what do you think they don't understand about their own anger?
Your anger isn't something for you to be afraid of. It is something for patriarchy to be afraid of. I think that is the most empowering thing that I have learned about my anger. It has brought me into community with other women in ways that I never imagined possible when I was growing up in an evangelical community. It has given me so much freedom to pursue a life that feels authentic. Anger is not the end of something. It's the beginning of your life.
Oh, I love that. I love that. I mean, patriarchy is only ever going to teach us to behave in ways that serve patriarchy. So I think always the question needs to be, why does patriarchy want me to think this? And what's something that's better for me that I can think? Gemma, your work is amazing and it's changing the world. And I'm just so glad that it's out there and that you are out there.
Yeah, I feel absolutely the same about you and your work and how accessible you make it for, those evangelical women that are hate following you to slowly come to the other side. I think it is so important to have people who are reaching out that hand and saying, it's okay. You can come over to this side. It's going to be okay. We're going to have your back.
Well,
And I think you do that really well.
I try. I've turned some of them into enemies as well, so I'm not sure how well I'm doing, but I'm doing something. I'm doing so, and that's all any of us can do. Gemma, thank you so much. I'm so excited to read your new book. I wish it was coming out sooner because I think it's going to be amazing.
Oh, you and me both.
Well, I think that people are going to love it. And if you have not read Gemma's first book, please do. It's being re-released next month, right?
Yes, so it is currently out of stock absolutely everywhere, but it is in its reprinting right now and it will come out on May 5th.
Amazing. So I recommend listeners subscribe to your Substack, which is just full of thoughtful ruminations on everything. I'll put links to that, to your books, and to everything else people can find out about you in the show notes. Thank you again for listening. Thank you, Gemma, for coming on, and I will be back with our next episode in 2 weeks.